Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about This is Monsteropolis, a show about legends, anomalies, and monsters, the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. I am one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined, as always, by my pal.
That'd be me, Mark Matzke. How are you, Seth?
You know, it's good. It's good to see you. It's been a while. It's been a few minutes since I walked out of the room, came back in.
You know, what's really weird is that at the time that this posts, we will be
in Maine.
In Maine,
yes,
the northeast corner of the United
for our
States.
Second time.
Yeah.
So one of the weird things about Mark and I is we've only known each other for what, 5 years?
Yes, five.
Six
years.
6 years. 2014, we started doing Sasquatch, right?
Right, that's correct.
So 5 years.
5 years.
5 years of us. And in that time, we have now traveled literally coast to coast. We've been Maine, Washington, Oregon, New York. We've been all over the country together.
The bayous of Louisiana.
Yep. I haven't been to Louisiana.
Oh, what am I thinking?
Arkansas.
Yeah,
they're close.
They are.
I gotta go to Louisiana. Isn't it ridiculous? We've been on the Shreveport TV station. I've never even been in the station, in the state,
in the station,
in the station state. To answer your question about how I am, I'm starving. We've been sitting here recording episode after episode, and now I'm hungry. And I'm on this diet, so like I'm hungry all the time anyway.
We'll forego the recipe episode.
Yeah,
that I had planned.
We gotta throw that out. We don't. The Bigfoot pot pie can't happen today.
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm really doing good, knowing that we've got that trip coming up.
Because
that's my stuff out there. Those are my people.
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this, it's already happened. Like it's happening now. The fourth annual International Cryptozoology Conference in Portland, Maine. But perhaps you're listening to this and you're somewhere in those New England states or farther over on the East Coast, and you want to just drive on up and hang out with us for a couple of days. Well, you should do that.
It's not too late.
Yeah. Eleanor, she's going to be there. She's flying out. Just found out the other day.
That's cool.
We'll be there. Mark's doing a talk on the Peninsula Python. Andy is doing a talk on how he settled on the name Crypto Kid for himself. And I am doing a talk. I'm not doing a talk at all. I'm showing Terror in the Skies and we might do a Q&A to follow. So there's a lot going on, and there's Cliff Berrickman, Ken Gerhard, Anna Nikaris, Belanger,
and others,
and John Tenney.
Oh yeah,
I don't know
him. That's something with Fortean in the title.
Fortean investigator. Fortean author.
Yes.
Okay. So we're gonna have a lot of fun at that event. I'm really excited to show Terror in the Skies, by the way. I just think I'm excited and nervous because it's kind of a departure from our last few movies. I think it's less of like a horror movie and much more of a sort of like mystery and adventure.
It's very fitting for that setting, I think. Mm-hmm. It's like perfect for the Cryptozoology Museum, I think.
Probably.
Because it really does, it delves into the kind of the hard cryptozoology mm-hmm. aspects of, you know, what kind of, if Thunderbird, if, what is it? Mm-hmm. You know, it gets into speculation about, you know, ancient forms of birds and even pterodactyls and stuff like that. Yeah. So it'll and be great.
I think, yeah, I'm really interested in seeing how that audience responds to it. It's going to be a little different. But yeah, this week we are talking about historical monsters. But before we get to some of these historical reports, we had a deluge of mail come in over the last month that we hadn't checked. If you want to send us emails, do it. Send them to monsteropolismail@gmail.com. And we'll read your missive on the show. Do you want to go through these?
Yes, let's do. This one is from Neil. It's RE episode 22, The Vanishing People. Good afternoon. Just wanted to let you know that I really enjoyed this episode. The pacing and backstories were great. Looking forward to the next episode.
We had a lot of fun with that episode. By the way, yeah, just as long as I'm thinking of it, we are posting Monsteropolis episodes to YouTube now, and there's some video and stuff to go along with them. I wouldn't call it a video show by any stretch of the imagination, but there are visuals, like there's different background pictures and kind of like a slideshow thing going on. And those are being edited by Binary Entertainment, Jason Mansfield. So if you are on YouTube and you want to watch the shows, if that's like an easier way to do things, it started with that episode. We started posting with that episode, and then he's going back and working his way back through the back catalog as well. So right now it's just episodes 22 and 23, but we'll have the other episodes coming as well. Oh, and that's on the Small Town Monsters YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Thanks, Neil, for the kind words about that episode. We had a lot of fun with that, and then we did two more episodes about missing people.
All right. This one is from Zachariah. Hello, gentlemen. Just wondering two things. If y'all have come across and y'all's thoughts on them. The first is reports on seeing UFOs with a night vision device on. The second is a Bigfoot-like creature appearing to have the ability to cloak, similar to what the predator in the movies. Thanks for y'all's thoughts on the questions, Zachariah.
I have. Did he ask if we directly have seen UFOs through?
No. That's very open ended. Just whatever our thoughts on these topics.
I mean, it'd be great if we can, because I just bought a couple of cameras specifically because they have night vision and we need to shoot a series about UFOs. So, but as far as like I don't know that I've ever talked to anyone who's seen one through night vision, but I've certainly seen what was purported to be, you know, footage of UFOs through night vision.
Yeah, I mean, that's, as a longtime coast listener,
yeah,
I've heard tell of that as a technique. And
I've you heard like tell. That? I heard tell of it.
Well, I'm getting into the spirit of the message here, but that seems to be, you know, something that is a technique. And I've never even had the opportunity to look through night vision.
So. I've got infrared on the new, I bought a new camcorder like last week for specifically for it on the trail that has considerably better infrared than that little ghost hunting camera we used on the trail of Bigfoot. As far as the cloaking Bigfoot thing, I really have only spoken to one person who claimed an experience similar to that. Interestingly enough, it was a former producer on an SDM, on the very first SDM movie. And he claimed he was in Salt Fork and they didn't see anything cloak, but they heard footsteps, where there were no footsteps. And so that was the only, they heard footsteps where there was no one walking. So that was that's the only experience I have of actually talking to someone who claimed to see like the cloaking Bigfoot.
I just recently watched a Bigfoot show, and it brought up something I'd never really thought about before, and that is the qualities of Bigfoot hair or fur could possibly have a refractive light quality to them. So it wouldn't be like some sort of mental projection of a cloak or, you know, like some metaphysical thing. It'd be just the qualities of the hair itself would reflect light, or would be have sort of the ghillie suit effect where you would just be able to blend in extremely well to your surroundings. And that was kind of interesting to me.
Yeah.
That like having a few silver hairs or something mixed in with your normal.
Yeah.
Like I do. Yep. It keeps me cloaked.
Yeah, that's true. I can never see you. Right now I'm talking to just open space.
Yeah, right. Glasses floating in midair.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's I think that's it for Zachariah's message.
Okay, cool.
And I know he is one of our best Twitter followers. Mm-hmm. So that is much appreciated.
Cool. Thanks, Zachariah. Matt emailed us, but I don't know if we can even read it.
Oh, yeah, we can.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Love the podcast, my dudes. It's very informative and a lot of fun. Have you all thought about doing an episode on troll folklore in Europe and ever here in the States? Again, the podcast is fantastic. Keep on trucking. Yeah, keep on trucking. I like that saying. Anyway, take care. P.S. There are a couple obvious words that autocorrected changed. I need to turn that off. Ha ha. And then he follows that up with, hey, boys, hope all is well. Disregard that last email. I was talking with this woman about troll sightings here in the States, and she ended up making it all up to just try and talk to me, which is kind of a bummer. And also very weird that someone would do that. I was wondering if you two know much about Skinwalker Ranch, and if you have ever be interested in doing an episode. Monsteropolis is one of my favorite podcasts. Easily. Have a good one.
Matt, the creator of the awesome Monsteropolis shirts that we were given at the on the Trail of Bigfoot premiere. Matt Shang. The Skinwalker Ranch, for sure. Like, we should do an episode or two on Skinwalker. We're also going to potentially do some Skinwalker related stuff in On the Trail of UFOs, which is still being kind of put together. So we'll figure that out a little closer to the actual shoot day. But yeah, it's always fascinated me. And I don't know why people have such a difficult time of doing this, but I feel like that story has not been boiled down to its essence. I feel like every time I see it, it's just people go off on rabbit trails. And that's the way I felt about that documentary that came out last year as well. Is I just felt like I wanted to know the story of the ranch. And instead you get, they start going off down like all these various rabbit trails that you can go off with that story. And you never actually just learn about the ranch. What's purported to have happened there and the sequence of events that has sort of led up to where we are today. Do you agree with that?
Like, yeah, I do. And just the history of the Uinta Basin, mm-hmm, in general,
yeah,
I think would be,
yeah,
would add a lot to that story as well.
Yeah.
And like you said, who's owned the ranch, who owns it now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not clear on any of that. And I think it would be really interesting. There's such a cornucopia of weird paranormal things that you can make it almost what you want it to be.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of what actually happened there. I've read the book. I'm a big George Knapp fan in general. So it's very well done, although it takes you in familiar directions. And what I mean by that is, you know, even when NIDS set up all of their stuff, you know, to try and capture some of this phenomena, none of it worked.
Right.
And it just seems to be like a variation on a theme at that point. You know, everything that we have to rely on is anecdotal. It's eyewitness testimony. And whenever people use, technology to try and track these things, it just consistently avoids that.
Yeah. So.
But yeah, it's a great, great story. And to go back to the troll thing, I wouldn't mind talking about the movie Troll Hunter on here sometime.
Dang, that's a great movie.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah,
that's a wonderful movie. So this week we want to talk about historical reports.
Do you want the last letter?
Was there one more? I thought that was it.
No, this is the
Oh, this is the big one.
This is the document.
Jeez, yeah. Yeah. Come on.
Okay.
Hey, bring it.
All right. This is from Steven. Howdy, Mr. Breedlove and the Breeders. Breedettes? Lovers? I'm writing to you to complain about your lack of moral guidance on the podcast. Shouldn't you include at least one cricket to keep up your moral compass on track?
That's true.
Would be a shame to turn into a bunch of jack A's. Anyway, the real point of the email.
Yeah.
I enjoyed your documentaries a lot and recently discovered your podcast. I'm a big fan of conspiracy and mystery topics, but one thing has always fascinated me, the complete lack of self-awareness in people who believe strange topics to put the puzzle pieces together. If you say there are powerful people in dark rooms plotting the future of nations and societies across the globe, people agree with you. call it the G8 or whatever, but if you say the Illuminati exists, they call you crazy, yet both are identical, and one is just a historical factual name for an attempt to do just that. Big business and lobbying both exists and doesn't exist for these people who hold their worldviews. Likewise, you have people who say you can't trust the government, but bully anyone who disagrees with government-mandated medicine. It's a hot topic, but vaccination's a good example. We have evidence the government has used false vaccination claims to test diseases on the public. Full disclosure, you can easily find recorded on places like Wikipedia even. I'm not taking a stance either way here, just a good example because of how viciously people get attacked for questioning something. If the government has previously infected people with diseases through claims of vaccination, it would be odd not to question if they would do it again and how they would use mandatory injections as the easy avenue. I thought it would be an interesting topic for a podcast, discuss how many paranormal types see government involvement in something as validation and how it relates to different topics. Does the government instigating Skinwalker Ranch validate it, or is it just a money laundering scheme where you can throw a few dollars at someone and then wrap it in red tape so no one can look at it twice? There's also stuff like MKUltra, but that's its own huge topic and would probably need to be its own discussion. I think it's an interesting thing to ponder, at least, and would make a good show. My only concern would be modern politics leaking into it and causing a storm. The exact government and which group leads it is rather irrelevant, considering how many decades of just recent government involvement in paranormal and conspiracy topics is. If it was handled well, it would transcend the current banter being waved about the general elite's interaction with the paranormal. From potential allied ETs to even technology being hidden or supernatural investigations such as the men who stare at goats. Various governments are wrapped up in so many things, I'm sure you could find a few good examples to natter about. Either way, really enjoying your work. I really like your small hometown approach. It's a nice change of pace, and I appreciate the effort you put in to tell those smaller personal stories over boombastic docudramas. Seeing the event and its cultural outcomes is a real treat. Thanks for your time. A listener from England. P.S. F you for your Mothman documentary. Mothman always creeped me out, but I decided to watch it as the only one left. The Grinning Man artwork got under my skin something fierce. Mothman no longer bothers me half as much as cold does. So didn't need a new fear like that.
That is an intense email.
I don't think I'd
ever broach directly the subject of like vaccinations on the show because the war that would break out
right
between Mark and I.
Yeah, so just that close, alone. Yeah,
just this room we're in right now would be a battleground.
It's bad enough talking about trailers.
Yeah. No. We both agree though that the trailers. You just have not been a fan of the musical choices.
Yes, it's only the music, and that's only because I'm a
curmudgeonly... That most recent trailer was ridiculous.
Yes, it was. Like, I agree completely. It's beautiful. Talking. It's a thing of beauty. Makes me want to cry.
But it's got way too much talking, and the talking is so stupid because it's just like people saying random things.
It's so random.
In 59 seconds.
Right.
Sorry, that was a tangent. Anyway... Godzilla's coming, guys.
Yes.
There's a lot to mine here for sure. And again, like Skinwalker itself would be an interesting side note to that. I know he wasn't directly talking about Skinwalker, but that is kind of plays into the larger picture of like government involvement and this stuff. I can say I definitely have seen the more recent like stories about the government investigating UFOs and things like that as a lot of people taking as sort of a... what is the word I'm looking for? They see it as a confirmation that they haven't been wasting their time, mm-hmm. like things like that. They're very excited about it, which is weird to me because the government's been looking into UFOs for decades, and we know this. So.
Yeah, they admit it. They admit it.
I'm confused about why all of a sudden everyone's freaking out because there's more recent confirmation that's going on.
The point that he brought out I really liked was the idea that, you know, there's some quote-unquote conspiracy fans who like to have it both ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you mention a specific group, it sort of raises their hackles, but then they are alleging that there's, you know, massive amounts of backroom dealing going on. And who knows? I mean, certainly, I think it's been said many times and in better ways than I could, but conspiracy theory as a whole, as a genre, if you want to think of it that way, is an attempt to make meaning of what happens in the world. I think more than anything, people hate the idea that it really could be just random events.
Yep.
Or people at the top are just incompetent to run these most important things. And we would rather have there be sinister motives than no motives at all.
Yeah.
So there's tons of stuff to mine in that.
Disclaimer, Mark's comment about people at the top being incompetent was not some sort of political attack. I don't want to get emails or messages about this. I think he's speaking in general terms about...
only talking about legendary pictures.
All right, look, though. The first trailer was great.
Yes.
You didn't like the music, but the imagery is all gorgeous.
Yeah, oh, it is.
I didn't know what I thought. This most recent, the Somewhere Over the Rainbow thing was pushing it slightly for me. And the fact, I could see that working in a teaser that's 2 minutes long, like the first teaser, but it doesn't work to do it again with a completely new song. And then the most recent cut, the 30-second trailer that came out like last week, was like a rap. It was rapping. There was rapping over it. Yeah. And that was even weirder for me because I'm like, how do we go from these first two trailers with this music to this?
Well, I wonder because, O'Shea Jackson Jr. is in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's going to be a Godzilla hip-hop rap track on the soundtrack. I wouldn't be against that necessarily, but...
I don't know. It'd be hard to top the P. Diddy... Come with me.
From 98. Yeah.
From 1998.
They took the Kashmir riff.
That had a hilarious music video.
It did.
Oh my gosh. I still remember watching it at my grandma's house. Okay. Can we, let's get into the topic of this week's show now that we're 22 minutes in. This week we're talking about historical reports. We've got about 15 minutes to cover this. Originally, we were going to redo our historical monster reports or historical Bigfoot reports, but I wanted to broaden it out to all monsters for a couple reasons. One, I wanted to talk about sea serpents, given the fact that we are going to be in Casco Bay right now, we're at the International Cryptozoology Conference. And one of your topics of conversation is going to be the Peninsula Python. So I don't know where you want to open this up at, but for sure I want you to talk about the Python, and I want to talk about this story called The Devil that I found, that someone, actually a friend of mine, Heidi, found for me and sent to me. So,
well, let's pick it up at, there's a historical Bigfoot report that I did want to bring up because of how old it is. And this is from the Bigfoot Casebook. One thing that I wanted to do is... nothing against the author or the book, but I wanted to avoid The Historical Bigfoot by Chad Arman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because we've talked about it ad nauseum on the other show.
That's like the first place I always go. Mm-hmm. So this is actually in the Bigfoot Casebook, the updated version, and this is a report that dates back to September 22nd, 1818. And Janet and Colin Board make the claim that this is the oldest North American newspaper report of a Bigfoot sighting yet discovered. So you can't get much earlier than the earliest one, if that is the claim.
Their claim is this is the earliest newspaper?
Yes.
Okay.
1818.
There's one from 17... No, I'm just kidding. Yeah.
And it's from New York, Sackett's Harbor, which is...
Well, 1818, it's not going to be... You're not going to get any further west,
right,
with the Wild Man reports or anything. That's interesting, too.
And where this is near is, if any listener might know, where Watertown, New York is, kind of heading due north out of Syracuse, New York. It's up in...
So that's heading toward Whitehall area.
Yeah.
Yeah, upstate.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is the report. We actually have it from the Exeter Watchman, again, of September 22nd.
I have a copy of this.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
That from when we were making Peace of Whitehall.
Oh, yeah. So it's Sackett's Harbor, New York, September 6th. Another Wonder is the headline. Report says that in the vicinity of Ellisburg was seen on the 30th by a gentleman of unquestionable veracity, an animal resembling the wild man of the woods. It is stated that he came from the woods within a few rods of this gentleman, that he stood and looked at him and then took his flight in a direction which gave a perfect view of him for some time. He is described as bending forward when running, hairy and the heel of the foot narrow, spreading at the toes. Hundreds of persons have been in pursuit for several days, but nothing further is heard or seen of him. The frequent and positive manner in which this story comes induces us to believe it. We wish not to impeach the veracity of this highly favored gentleman, yet it is proper that such naturally improbable accounts should be established by the mouth of at least two direct eyewitnesses to entitle them to credit.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's weird that I said that about it wouldn't be any earlier than 1818. When did Lewis and Clark head out? That was 18. Was that 1800 or 17? I'm trying to think because I literally am just doing this stuff with the Alton, and now I can't think of the dates. But it would be interesting to see as those newspapers spring up across the West, like as that expansion is starting to take place.
Yeah,
when the stories really do start coming in, because you got a wild man report from Ohio in 1869, and that's kind of heading out that way. Like, I know there's very early reports from Kansas of thunderbirds. Like, I'm just curious about when some of those reports really start coming up as the newspapers themselves start expanding.
How long did it take for a newspaper to be established?
And then start diving into, like, oh, there's monsters here.
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
Well, on that same sort of bent, 1860, hold on a second. Give me 1 second. I have to get the exact date for this because this is really important because this is a really great little side story that people don't talk about. So I have a report that was found from Argus, Missouri, Macon, Missouri. The Macon Argus is the name of the newspaper. 1868. So this story is super cool for a couple of reasons we're going to get into. I sent it to you about a week ago, but I'd never heard it before. Macon, Missouri is only about 70 to 90 miles, I think I said, from Louisiana, Missouri, home to the, maybe I shouldn't even say anything else. Let me just get into the story. So the story, 1868, is called The Devil. An extraordinary creature discovered in the forests of Warren County, Missouri, a nondescript animal of singular and frightful appearance roaming at large. The following extraordinary story, which for want of space we have been compelled to condense, we have received from a perfectly reliable source about 20 miles from this city, but in this county is a small stream known as Bear Creek, which empties into Big Black River. The margin of both of these streams in that vicinity from miles back is an almost impenetrable swamp grown up with cane brakes and wild tangle vines, but filled up with all kinds of game, including bear, deer, and turkeys. In pursuit of this game, many young men resort to this spot with their hounds. For some time past, strange stories have been told of an extraordinary animal seen near these swamps. In their usual manner, gave graphic and startling descriptions of his appearance, but usually winding up with declaration that it was the devil which had been seen by them. One peculiarity was that from his tracks, he seemed to be going both ways at once. That is, one foot pointed to the front and the other to the rear. These stories were laughed at and derided by the citizens, no one believing in any such statements. This extraordinary creature had often suddenly presented himself in the early twilight, causing great and consternation among them. He is described as being 8 feet high, eyes as large as a hen egg, with no nose and upper lip, his two eye teeth as large as a man's thumb extending down from his chin about 8 inches, his right foot points directly to the front and the left one to the rear. The measurement of the track is 23 inches in length. His fingernails are perfectly hard and solid and are about 6 inches long. The hair on his head, which is stiff and wiry, sweeps the ground as he walks. And is parted in the rear and brought down in front on each side of his singularly formed chest, which is not round nor flat, but is angular like that of a fowl. The hair on the body of the singular being is very stiff and grows to the rear, parting at the angle of the breastbone, growing back and uniting with a long, stiff growth on his spine, which extends back about 1 foot like the spinal fin of a fish or the bristles on the back of a boar. The hair on his arms is parted and grows in the same way, making a long, thick brush on the back of the arms, extending from the shoulders to the point of his fingers. Same peculiarity is observable on his legs. It goes on and on with this, but my favorite part of this is when the posse appears, because that's as always, I'm a big fan of posses just in general. So they eventually go out in search of the devil. And this is what happened. A being apparently human and something, this is very dark right there, turned for a moment, stood in silent inspection of his pursuers, and then instantly with a yell, truly terrific, wheeled and with the speed of the fastest horse rushed away from the dogs. This wild and exciting chase was continued for a distance of nearly 10 miles when at last the terrible monster, foaming with rage, was brought to bay upon the bank of the Big Black, and turning with a fury unparalleled, it seized the foremost dog with both hands, and by the exercise of superhuman muscular strength, buried its long talons in the body of the howling brute and literally tore the dog asunder. Dropping this, it instantly seized the next and sent its two immense tusks through the skull of the doomed dog. One of the hunters became alarmed for the safety of the party, drew his revolver, fired twice at the monster, but evidently without effect, other than to frighten it by the report. When turning with a hideous yell, it plunged into the river, diving and remaining underwater fully 5 minutes, when it would suddenly spring high into the air, screaming with the voice of a regiment of soldiers. It finally swam to the opposite side, disappeared in the neighboring forest, since which time it has only been seen twice. Several attempts have been made to capture it, but up to the present time without success. So the only reason I'm super into this story is because it's taking place fairly close to Louisiana, Missouri, home of the Missouri monster Momo, and bears some similarities, especially in the hair growth, which is weird. You don't typically hear of this sort of like completely covered in hair kind of description, especially at this period of time, until the 70s, when all of a sudden you get into like monster reports, like Big Muddy Monster and Minerva Monster, where it's like a being that's covered hair, head to toe in hair. Now, there are some also really bizarre descriptions here, like the feet and the fact that it supposedly had tusks, which we called it tusk face when I first sent this to you.
Yeah.
Classic tusk face situation. Yep. But it also seems to hate dogs, which is something else that the Missouri monster was said to do, was kill dogs. So I just thought there were some cool similarities, and to have that taking place in 1868 in the state of Missouri, you know, like you have to wonder if that somehow inspired the Minerva monster or the Missouri monster stories, or if, you know, like you have, There's all sorts of ideas we start to ponder them.
Yeah, yeah. There's a fantastical blend of stuff that sounds like a contemporary Bigfoot report in that, but mixed in with some of the other like more folkloric.
The feet thing is like, the weirdest. You know, like that really just sounds like it's some story that's being told, you know, to scare people.
Yeah, and the stuff at the end where he like is underwater for 5 minutes, then bursts up and
screaming like a regiment of soldiers. Now, having said that, some of those Momo sightings, the fisherman sighting, it was coming up out of the river. Even the Harrison boys, the other two Harrison boys, saw it come out of the river. So, so there, I thought of that was actually one of the descriptions or behavioral things that they mentioned that I thought sounded like the Missouri monster.
Yeah. You just wonder. And of course, we'll never know, but how much embellishment goes into a description like that?
Yeah.
How much of it's based on fact? And it's really interesting to go back and look at those newspapers as you've done over the eras and just see the styles of writing.
Yeah.
Like even if you were to look at an old description of a baseball game, for example, I mean, it's completely different than the way.
Sounds like a war being waged. Yeah.
Right. So I would, and no one would suggest no baseball game took place, but it's just a whole different way of talking about it.
So. Yeah. Like we discovered that too when we were looking at the airship reports. Yeah. What do you got?
Well, what should we do? I mean, what kind of time?
Well, we're at 34 minutes as of right now, 30 plus minutes. I would get into your Peninsula Python, and we might have to revisit this subject when we come back to do shows again, do a Historical Monsters Part 2 next.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Peninsula Python story is one that I love because it, what is at the center of it is kind of to continue what we were talking about just now, is the media. There would be no Peninsula Python craze without the media's involvement in the story. And what you find in the story of the Peninsula Python is one personality at the center of it all. It's a reporter by the name of Robert Bordner. And all this took place, it started in the year 1944 with a series of sightings of a large python-looking snake in and around the banks of the Cuyahoga River near Peninsula, Ohio. And that's part of the reason why this story holds such fascination for us, I think, is because this is a place that we can continue to go.
And we have hiked a number of times together.
Absolutely. Right? And
we did the first Sasquatch meetup, both Sasquatch meetups there.
Right. Yep. And when you dig into the story itself, what you very quickly discover is that there are a number of names and places that you can still go to today. The track of the snake was found in the field of the Zale family, and Zale Farms continues to operate a large produce area in the Cuyahoga Valley. And you go down there on weekends especially, you can hardly get in the place.
Yeah, you can't get it. It's just packed out.
Yeah. And so as John and Paul Zale, who founded that enterprise, are also publicly credited in these news stories as having found a huge snake track in their field. And that's one of the details about the story that it gives me a lot to think about, because it doesn't seem to me that they are people who would knowingly foist a hoax upon the public. I can't imagine that would do good things for your business. Having said that, Robert Bordner certainly did seem to love being at the center of the tale and loved being the one through whom the tale was being told, to the degree that whether or not you buy the Peninsula Python story, which is fascinating in itself and culminates in a posse hunt for the creature, he went on a year later to invent an entirely separate hoax that he did confess to ultimately, and that was a hunt for buried gold in the hills of the Cuyahoga National Valley area. And so I don't know, we could get into the individual sightings if you wanted.
Yeah, describe what the creature was said to look like, the Peninsula Python. And for listeners who might not be familiar, like, the Cuyahoga Valley is actually somewhere between where Mark lives and where I live. So I'm in Wadsworth. Mark is up near Painesville.
Painesville.
Painesville. I almost said it's Plainsburg, but it's kind of between us. And it's a national park now, but it wasn't actually turned into a national park until the late 90s, I believe. It was originally it's a weird national park because there's towns and there's people living in it, and it's just not what you'd imagine, but it is a gorgeous place. It's probably one of my favorite hiking places in the state of Ohio. And it is certainly, when you're there, and especially in some of the more remote areas, you could look out and imagine you are far removed from civilization, even though you're actually sandwiched right in between two of the biggest cities in the entire state, in Akron and Cleveland. In fact, the entire park is sort of shared by the Metro Park system for Cleveland and Akron. But it's a beautiful place, remote looking, even though it isn't actually remote.
Right. And it's unlike some other national parks in the sense that it's completely free. Anywhere you want to go in there, you just go.
Yeah.
And it's well used for that reason. The description of the creature, I'll just pull from the very first sighting. This took place on June 8th, 1944. A farmer named Clarence Mitchell was in his field, and he told Robert Bordner in an interview, He looked up to see the biggest snake he had ever seen. It seemed like 10 minutes he watched. It was as thick as my thigh, every bit of 15 feet long, more like 18, sort of brownish spotted. I went over and looked at the track. It was like you'd rolled a spare tire across my field. So, I mean, it's not an immensely huge, unusually big python. It's certainly not native snake. I don't think it would be confused with even like a rat snake or a large black snake that you would potentially see around here. But it's not, you know, a gargantuan kaiju size snake at the same time. That would go on to be a description that would repeat, which is to say the not just the physical description of the snake itself, but it would leave like a tire track sized singular impression, track throughout fields. Yeah, that's what.
Are there photos?
Somewhere there's a photo of the Zales in the field, but I don't know if the track line shows up in it or not. Okay. I will have to go back and look. But there's certainly pictures of all the principal people that are named.
Mm-hmm.
And there's plenty of pictures, even of the day where the posse formed to go out searching.
So yeah, and the town today has sort of embraced this, right? They still do. Do they still do the Python Festival?
Peninsula Python Day is still going.
Okay.
Different
do you have a date this year? I would like to go. I can't remember why I didn't last year.
Yeah, yeah. It's typically been in June, mm-hmm. a summer month. There's sometimes a parade. It was postponed this past year due to weather,
mm-hmm.
but there's a big Peninsula Python float. It's actually shaped like a giant snake that they didn't bring out because they thought it would get rained on, and they didn't want it to get rained on. But the businesses embrace it. I think the most profound way that the legend continues to live on is through the local library. There is a really beautiful mural that's there that is an artistic representation of the Python story.
Mm-hmm.
It even incorporates the Cleveland Press newspaper articles are part of the mosaic itself and tells the entire story, basically, if you know what you're looking at, from the snake dropping out of the tree by the farmer woman to the posse forming and the National Guard marching into town on the same day. That's all in this artwork by Honoré Gilbo Cook, who was a friend of Robert Bordner's as well.
Do you think the popularity of that story had anything to do with it being a response to World War II? Because this is 1944, so like,
yeah.
do you think that was like a nice escape for people? Is all of a sudden, instead of being afraid of like Nazis and you know the axis, the axis of evil?
Yeah, there's a lot to that. There's a lot to that. Uh-huh. This was at a time where people were still in our region in Northeast Ohio, were living on edge. I mean, you didn't know if the next day would bring news that your loved one had perished in battle. So there was a certain sort of angst that was still very much present in the area. And there was, I'm not really great at World War II history, but there was some major conflict or battle that had just taken place a week or so prior. So it was still ratcheting up to a certain degree. It was towards the end of the war, but I think it you can't not look at that situation, and especially the idea that this was a media-driven event, and not think that maybe there was some way that this was a release or just something fun
mm-hmm.
to occupy your imagination relative to the other more ghastly things
happening.
And he
was a newspaper man, so he had to know. He would have known that this is going to be a successful story because mm-hmm. it's...
And it was picked up by the AP, like all these... And modern era stories tend to take on a life of their own in a way that the Minerva Monster would later on be picked up internationally.
Do you have anything else you want to say about the Python this week? And then we can come back to this next week and wrap up on the historical monsters and get into some. I have a bunch of sea serpent reports I want to get into that I discovered back when I was helping Alex with the champ on the Trail of Champ. So. wrap. Or do you, well, no, we'll wrap up next week. So we'll be back next week. More historical monster reports. Hopefully, we are seeing you right this moment at the
yes,
at the International Cryptozoology Museum Conference. And yeah, thanks for listening. Visit us on Facebook, social media, Twitter. Leave us reviews, ratings, and you can watch the Monsteropolis episodes now on YouTube. Just visit the Small Town Monsters YouTube channel and check those out.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.